Welcome to Radio Disclosure. And like I always say, don't touch that dial. Because today we've got Stanton Friedman and Linda Moulton Howe. It's all about flying saucers and UFOs. But before we get into that, and before we do anything else, I want to remind you about the MUFON Tennessee Conference coming up. And that's December the 5th, 2009. Starts at 9 a.m., goes till 4 p.m. That's on a Saturday, December the 5th. It's at Baymont Inn and Suites in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, which is about the middle part of the state. So if you've been driving distance, and listen to this, the admission's only $20. They also have Jay Billings coming in. He's an astrophysicist. And also Brent Raines, international UFO investigator and editor of Alternate Perceptions magazine. And he's got a presentation on the top 10 close encounter cases. And also Jay Billings is going to be talking about astronomy for field investigators. $20, along with Stanton Friedman, and of course his new book, Flying Saucers and Science. And the reason, one thing I wanted to do is last week we did a show with Eddie Middleton, and we talked about the conference, and I got a bunch of MUFON hate mail. And I'm just going to be right honest with you. That's just exactly what it was. Based on the fact that somebody inside a MUFON, somebody pretty high up on the command chain, had made some statements at a public conference. And here is what I had someone write me. It says that the MUFON current director at Ryan Woods Conference in Las Vegas 2 weekends ago did a presentation that proposed there was never any non-human crash or bodies in the Roswell, New Mexico area, that it was all a cover-up for another U.S. intelligence operation. A guy sitting next to me who works for NASA in the propulsion systems turned to me and said, "This is BS. I could not agree more. Everyone thought that the director was the fox in the hen house, and he does have a military intelligence background, which he at least admits to." Well, you know, I guess my comment is, when you listen to this program with Stanton Friedman, we're going to address some of these issues. You know, if you don't believe certain things, not everybody believes everything, but that's no reason to bow out a MUFON or walk away from MUFON. It's all the more reason to get more involved in MUFON and let your objections be known. I wouldn't want that fellow speaking on my behalf. It's okay for a person to have their personal beliefs. I mean, who would want to deny somebody of that, you know? But to make such a bold blanket statement as if that's the, you know, is that MUFON's official position? No, I don't think so, or they wouldn't be having Stanton Friedman in for a conference. But anyways, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Get to this conference and listen to Stanton Friedman. And the only thing I can say is take all the other statements that this gentleman is making with a grain of salt. Don't let that disturb your position as far as MUFON is concerned. You know, I think they're a good organization. They have good intentions. And this gentleman probably has good intentions as well. But then again, who knows? Maybe not. You never know where the government's going to plant somebody to try to detour honest investigation or to plant misinformation. I mean, I don't trust our government, and if you do, then, you know, that's your privilege. But anyhow, enough of all of this. Murfreesboro, Tennessee, December the 5th. Plan on coming. There's more information upcoming on the site. And I didn't want to have to talk about this, but with a number of people emailing and calling that seem to be upset with MUFON over the statements that this man is making, I just want to say, look, don't worry about that. Don't worry about this guy. Show up, be counted, and be a part of this organization. And problems like that take care of themselves. You know, they just give it enough time. Well, we're going to be back with Stanton Friedman and Linda Moulton Howe on Radio Disclosure. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Trans World Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. Our guest is Stanton Friedman. I don't think I really need to give this man an introduction. Everyone knows Stanton's background. You've seen him on every conceivable television channel and all kinds of television specials. He's the author of a number of books. Stanton goes back in UFO research and flying saucer research back as far as anyone can possibly go. And I believe he's the world's foremost expert on flying saucers.
I'll pay you later, Ted.
as well as the incident at Roswell. I was going to say something to you. I was going to open up with this because something happened to me really just last night. I had flipped on the television and I was flipping around through all of the Extends commercials and everything else it was on, and I happened on, I believe it was the History Channel, and they were doing quite a documentary on the assassination of President Kennedy. And of course they took you through everything. There was footage on this special I had never seen. Oh. And of course some of it was black and white, but it was just crystal clear. And of course, I remember the fuzzy black and white images of a long time ago, and I remember I was in school. I was in a band class when they announced that President Kennedy had been assassinated, and my dad, I remember my dad being glued to the television set for like 3 or 4 days. I mean, it was like it was just went on and on and on, and I mean, it was kind of strange because we were at that point in time in history where we actually saw, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald gets shot on live television, you know, which was something that had never happened before. But what was interesting was afterwards the press conferences they had and the law enforcement people, the government people, when they began to answer questions and the press would ask a question about the possibility of a conspiracy theory or was this person connected with that person, or what was the real reason why Jack Ruby actually shot Oswald? Did they have any common background? And I began to listen and watch the expression on the faces of the people who were participating as part of the government and part of the press. And, you know, it was that same expressionless, canned sort of demeanor that you see when you see the clips of the military trying to explain what happened at Roswell. Uncanny. I mean, it was like I sat here, and I mean, it just hit me. I thought, my God, this is the same stuff. This is exactly the same stuff. There's no difference.
I remember an example of that. I was in England in 1997, a couple of weeks before the 50th anniversary of Roswell. And I happened to turn on the television set. I had something to do with giving a lecture or doing a television program or something over there. And there was the announcement about the crash test dummies. And I was appalled by the suggestion, but even more so, some smart guy in the press asked, well, when did that happen? And, well, 1953, but people's memories are confused. I mean, it was one of those, what did he say? You know, we know when Roswell happened. It was 1947. How do you account for a 1947 event with a 1953 or a later event? And watching that guy trying to, it was a colonel, Haynes, I think his name was, trying to avoid coming to grips with the simple fact that what he was saying was nonsense. And, I know what you mean. And I've seen, and I read a lot of this government junk, and there are times when, I have an article on my website, and there's a chapter in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, about government UFO lies. And it's a long chapter because there are lots of lies. I don't mean just bending the truth a little bit. I mean flat-out lies. I was saying something had happened at least in the earliest 1953 explains people's reports from 1947 as absurd. You know, there's no getting around that. And there were many, many others. And so it's hard not to take off the gloves and point out the ridiculousness of government explanations. One that I use often has to do with the biggest study ever done for the United States government for Project Blue Book, Project Blue Book Special Report 14. And the Secretary of the Air Force, in the official press release that went all over the place, this is in 1955, flat out lied. It's what shook me up the most in my early reading about flying saucers. I didn't know which way to go. Read about 15 books, and some of them were crap, frankly. And if I'd read them first, I'd have never read another one. And here I find a copy at the University of California, Berkeley Library, a privately published version of, this is before Freedom of Information, of Blue Book Special Report 14. And he included the press release. And here's the Secretary of the Air Force saying, out. He says, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been explained as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Now, I just looked at the report, which has 246 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. Data heaven for a guy like me. And how in the world could he say that? The unknowns were 21.5%. They weren't 3%. They, by definition, weren't the sightings for which there wasn't enough information. There was another category, insufficient information. And there's a lot more, and I talk about this in Flying Saucers and Science, but you know, how could such a bold-faced lie? And nobody complained about it at the time. The press carried the press release all over the country. You know, New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. And it was false, flat out false, not maybe, not slightly off center, but it was baloney. How could they do that? And, you know, I don't know. I think it takes an old Yiddish word, chutzpah, a gall, you know, to stand up and say something totally false. And nobody complains about it at the time, anyway. I mean, I didn't start complaining about it until my first lecture was, 67? This was 55, so it was 12 years later before I started saying something about it.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems is, of course, our society is so money-driven, that I think what it is the politicians and the heads of large corporations, they worry about the economy, and they're afraid that any kind of word was to get to the street that told the truth about things would so upset the balance of things, it would hurt them in the wallet. I really think that's probably the biggest fear. I don't think people are afraid of religion or religious problems. I don't think they could. I think they could care less about that. I mean, if you look at big business and you look at our government, you see very little religion of any kind. You see a lot of dollars and cents, you know. And I really think that because it doesn't take much. Look at the effect that 9/11 had on our economy, you know. And I think they fear this. And I think I just believe there's a deal they got going. I think that. The big corporations and the government together are saying, look, we got to put a throttle on this. If this were to get out, this would totally turn our economy upside down. And
it would also turn upside down the power structure of the world, because anybody who pushed for an earthling orientation is going to be in trouble, because nationalism is the only game in town. And Americans certainly don't want a one-person, one-vote election to decide who speaks for planet Earth, who negotiates. Mm. And, you know, there's India with a billion people being treated very well right now, today, I guess, at the White House. There's China with 1.3 billion being treated well because they're the United States banker. With only 305 million people, you can't hope to compete with that on a one-vote, one person kind of basis. So, but I think what you're saying is true. I mean, I have my reasons for the government not wanting to reveal information. But I think the one you just enunciated, that is, the fallout would be financially detrimental to so many people. That probably is a primary motivation, because nobody gives a darn about what's best for the planet. That's not the question that's asked. What's best for me and for my company and for my government? That's what matters. And, you know, I see the same thing. This may shock you, but I've been looking at the man-made global warming, anthropogenic, what a fancy word. You know, CO2 is the evil CO2. We have to defeat it and spend hundreds of billions of dollars to do it. Well, there's a chapter in the book that I'm almost finished with about global climate. The book is Science Was Wrong. And I've been looking into the IPCC, International Climate Change Panel on Climate Change. And there is so much baloney that's been published. I thought I was reading UFO stuff. There's gradually, the last few weeks have seen a lot more interest in getting a more, objective look at the situation. But, somebody once said, I guess it was Hitler, if you're going to tell a lie, tell a big one. Here we got two, saucers and climate. And I'm not saying there's a connection between those two. And people talk about conspiracies. Sometimes there's a lot of different people who may not even like each other, but who have a common interest in the truth not getting out.
I think that one of the problems we've got with science, period, okay, is I think we assume that we know a whole lot more than what we really know. You know,
the point of this book.
We haven't been around long enough.
That aren't true.
Well, we haven't been around long enough. Now, let me just give you an example. We'll get off the beaten path here just for a second. But I can recall a long time ago, I used to love theater popcorn because they popped it in coconut oil. You know, and I remember doctors telling me, oh, my God, whatever you do, do not eat coconut oil. That will collect in your arteries like STP, okay? Yeah. Now, you heard this. Today, the health food stores are selling coconut oil, and they say it unclogs arterial plaque. And there are physicians that are saying that that's the case. Then, there was the thing, do not eat eggs. All these egg substitutes, don't eat eggs. It's bad for you, you know. And now they're saying, oh, but eggs have the good cholesterol in them. They're not a problem. Eat as many eggs as you want to. I don't think they know anything. I think we haven't been around long enough to establish some things, and I think the global warming thing fits right into the middle of that. I mean, how long have we been here? How long can we really say that we have all these accurate weather records going? Well, where are they? I've never seen them.
Let me tell you something. It's just come out that 89 or maybe it's up to 90% of the ground weather stations in the United States, there's about 1,100, 1,200 of them, are not sited in a fashion which reflects the regulations of the weather organizations. It's supposed to not be too close to sources of heat, for example. That would be a good idea, wouldn't it, for a weather station? 90% don't meet the criteria that have been set. And actually, much better data comes from the satellite data. And that shows that for 10 years, the globe hasn't been warming. And there have been times when CO2 levels were higher. And, we make CO2 evil, but plants are desperate for CO2, for growth. You want your plants to have good yields, your grains and so forth. You need CO2. So let's not talk as if it's a poison, for goodness sakes. It's crazy. The scientific method has got left out in the heat recently, I think. And it bothers me because when I went to college, and I worked my way through college, and I thought it was important for me to adopt the scientific method, I wasn't there to have fun at parties and stuff, and I worked hard. And now I hear science being brushed aside in favor of bias and strong opinions without evidence and false reasoning. My goodness. What happened to the world,
Well, okay, now, flying saucers, and I know you love to use that term.
Because I'm interested in flying saucers. I'm not interested in UFOs. All flying saucers are UFOs. Very few UFOs are flying saucers. All great-grandfathers are men. I'm one of them, as a matter of fact. But not all men are great-grandfathers. So I'm interested in flying saucers. I don't care about, I'm like the basketball coach says, don't tell me about the midgets. Give me a 7-footer. Yes, I know most people aren't 7 feet tall. That doesn't matter. Find me the one who is.
Well,
So I'm interested in flying saucers.
Okay, the one subject that could be, and probably is, the most important thing that our planet could even contemplate at this point in time. I mean, it's only common sense. Of course, we don't see a whole lot of common sense today, but nonetheless, it's still common sense.
Not very common, yes.
Now, the question I have, though, is that, we have had all this documentation on, all kinds of different things have been documented, and yet, I don't know what kind of proof people are wanting. I mean, I hear people talking about where, we need to get disclosure, we need to get this. My question is how much proof do you need? I think
evidence. I talk about evidence. I mean, mathematicians can talk about proof, And sometimes in the legal business, if you're talking DNA and fingerprints, you can really get proof. But most situations, I've asked the judge about this. I said, what percentage of the cases do you have something as solid as, say, DNA? Very small. You're dependent on testimony. That's why we have a system the way we do. We have, for the defense and for the prosecution. And there's certain rules about how you go about it. And so, yes, there is far more evidence than should be required to establish pretty close to beyond a reasonable doubt. What's the, not the criminal, but the non-criminal kind of stuff in court is a preponderance of the evidence, right?
Yes, that's what convicts.
not 99% required, sometimes 51%. But for saucers, no, I have these nasty, noisy negativists saying, give me a body. My goodness, what kind of nonsense is that? It neglects the body's approach to all of this stuff. You want them to come down and say, hi, Earth, we've been traipsing around and we noticed your planet out here and we thought we'd stop by for a visit and can you get us on all your television channels so we can talk to the people on the planet? Is that what they're expecting? Do they expect the government with its crash wreckage to put it out there and say, we invite scientists from all over the world to examine this stuff to see if they can figure out what the materials are and how they were made and how we can duplicate them and develop high-performance aircraft. You'd all like that, wouldn't you? I mean, that's absurd that we think that any government, not just the American government, would do that. We sometimes forget. Saucers are seen all over the planet. They even seem to crash in other parts of the planet. So it's not like America has grabbed the market on crash saucers. I was in Brazil. The Varginha case, a good case. And there apparently have been others around the planet. So I find some of the complaints from the noisy negativists is absurd. But I should point out, and there's a chapter in Flying Saucers and Science about the poll results, opinion polls. And they come as a shocker to the bad guys because they've shown that there are more believers than non-believers. And the greater the education, the more likely to believe. And yet the noisy negativists keep telling you the great majority of people don't believe. This is all baloney. That's what people believe. Scientists certainly don't believe in UFOs. I've talked to loads of scientific groups. I am extremely well-received. That's why I went full-time, because I was so well-received by engineers and scientists at, places like the Engineering Society of Detroit, the Engineering Society of Baltimore, Engineering Society of Cincinnati, half a dozen sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. I've been out there. I always have a question and answer period after my lecture, and it's open. No written questions, nothing like that. First hand up gets the first chance to talk. So I've been out there, and the problem is the fear of ridicule. And apparently that's one of the major emotional concerns of people in our society. They don't want to be laughed at. That's important. And so the government or whoever's behind the cover-up has been very successful at creating a laughter curtain, a fear of ridicule. And it's very sad that people are afraid to stand up. At the end of my lecture, I ask how many people have seen a flying saucer. And the hands go up reluctantly, but typically it's 10%. Then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? Maybe at most 10% of the 10%. And when I ask people at my table when I'm signing books and stuff like that, they want to tell me about their sighting. Got to tell somebody who's not going to laugh, Did you report it? No. Why not? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. So somebody, whoever's deciding how you handle large-scale concerns like this, seems to be well aware that fear of ridicule is enough to shut people up. And that's a shame.
Well, that's absolutely true.
I wonder how many other subjects it holds true on, incidentally.
Let me ask you a question, though, and I wanted to ask specifically about Roswell. Now, we did a show here not too long ago, and you went into quite a few things. Incidentally, I want to stop right here and just mention the fact that Stanton's book, Flying Saucers and Science, this is the latest one that's out right now, is excellent. Excellent book. If you have questions about flying saucers, UFOs, and things in the sky, you need a copy of this book. You really need to read it from cover to cover several times, because it's an easy read, but there's a lot of information in there. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I didn't know. And a lot of stuff after I read the book, I know I'm not going to remember it. I'll remember parts of it, because that's usually how you retain things. But I want to ask you, and I want to mention Flying Saucers and Science. I also want to mention the fact that Stanton's going to be in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, for the MUFON conference, and this is coming up December the 5th. So mark that on your calendar. If you are, Murfreesboro is about center of the state, so state of Tennessee. So if you're anywhere within driving range, by all means, make plans now to attend this thing. But now, let me move on. I want to ask about Roswell. I heard a statement. I read this on the internet. I won't quote who said it, but matter of fact, I was a little shocked that the person that said it said that a intelligence that would come to our planet from another star system would not crash. That was an emphatic statement made, and I thought, where is this coming from? Now, I want to ask about that, and can you tell me about the specifics in regards to what documentation we have in regards to the bodies that were recovered from the Roswell crash?
Okay. The first question, let us understand that we, in our infinite wisdom, often build two-part systems. I'll call it a mothership and a little Earth excursion module. In other words, you got two different problems. It's like when I go to the airport. The airport doesn't land in my backyard. I drive a car. I take a relatively small plane from there to a big city. Then I take a big plane from there to where I'm going and repeat the process in return. The big plane that finally gets me back doesn't land in my backyard. Well, the United States Navy has for many years, and many other navies do too, have a two-part system. They got the huge aircraft carriers, which are roughly 1,100, 1,200 feet long. And it may shock some people to realize that these can operate for 18 years without refueling. These are nuclear-powered. They are not burning diesel fuel, and you can imagine how much fuel that saves. So that's the motherships. They carry any roughly 75 small airplanes, which don't work worth a darn on the water, but have very high performance in the air, maneuverable, high altitude, all that sort of thing. They can last an hour or two without refueling. Now, if we go over to the UFO situations, on the one hand, we have numerous reports of huge motherships, say between half a mile and a mile long. That's huge as far as I'm concerned. And out of which one sees on occasion small, what I call Earth excursion modules, little flying saucers, if you will. The big ship is to get between the stars. When you're in the vicinity of a planet, being able to go the speed of light doesn't do you a darn bit of good. It takes a seventh of a second to go around the planet. But there's an atmosphere. There are all kinds of problems with having an atmosphere and a high gravitational field. Between the stars, these things don't exist. So nobody is saying, I know of no case in which somebody has reported a huge mothership crashing. But the Roswell case didn't involve a huge mothership. None of the reports that we have of that one or the crash in Aztec, New Mexico the following March, or as a matter of fact, in the plains of San Augustine at the same time in July of 1947. Nobody's talking about a huge monster. We're talking about a little guy, 30, 40 feet. Ted Phillips has collected over 3,800 cases in which people in 90 countries have seen saucers on or near the ground, and about a sixth of those involve reports of creatures next to them. And these are all, one would have to say, these are physical trace cases now, not crop circle kind of cases, but cases where you can see something after the saucer leaves, the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing remarks. Anyway, none of these cases involve huge motherships. They're typically 20 to 40 feet in diameter. So the notion that nobody from someplace else would crash here, not in their mothership. But you may have noticed we got a couple of shuttles that have crashed. They're very expensive, very sophisticated. What happened? Unexpected. Strange things. A bit of ice caused one of them, which sounds weird, but it did. And some insulation that got off caused another one. We're talking about man isn't perfect. His vehicles aren't perfect. His equipment isn't perfect. I got a great computer on my desk here, not a really fancy one, but it isn't perfect. Sometimes it stalls and I have to shut it down and reboot, and there it goes. Let Bill Gates take that kind of thing. It's Windows. That's the problem.
Well, before we went on the air, I mentioned to you that I thought that individual computers have individual personalities, that they were like women. But I don't want to say that on the radio, okay?
Okay, don't say that on the radio.
I'm not going
to
say that on the radio.
What I'm trying to say here is anybody who makes a claim like that, A, presumes he knows a lot about advanced civilizations when there's no evidence he knows anything about advanced civilization. I mean, did he get this from talking to 12 captains of interstellar craft who told him, oh, our craft never crashed? Where did it come from? He pulled it out of the air. Part of this that we're dealing with here is ego. If this something like this were true, I would know about it because I'm so smart, and I don't, so it must not be true, and anybody who says it is some kind of a nut.
But I smell cover-up in that, though. I smell a little cover-up going on there, a little anti-intelligence information. You know, well, now, think about it.
Of course.
If they're coming here from Zeta Reticuli and they got enough going for them to go from there to here, they aren't going to crash. I mean, you know, don't you just hear that? I mean...
Yes, I do, and I think it's silly. As a matter of fact, somebody made a statement like that at the MUFON conference in August where I was one of the speakers. And I immediately jumped in and said, no, we're not talking about a craft that came here from there crashing. We're talking about something that was brought here and then crashed. And, you know, there's a big difference. But let's not be presumptuous about what we know. I mean, people tell me, oh, aliens wouldn't act that way. And how is it that you know that? I say, you have dinner with a bunch of aliens? It's mind-boggling the way people jump to conclusions when they don't want to deal with the evidence. David Susskind, when he had a television show, this is years ago in New York, and I was there, and I gave him everything he wanted to people and so forth. And he says between segments that, you know, I read the New York Times. I don't see anything in there that says these things are real. And it's a syndrome. In other words, I take great pride in knowing about what's important in the world. If aliens were visiting, that would be important. If it were important, I would know about it. I don't, so it must not be true, but there's no point in wasting my time on something that I know not to be true. Not because I've studied the evidence, which would be the way it should be approached by a journalist or a scientist, but because my ego tells me that it can't possibly be true, or I would have ignored the biggest story of the millennium for 60 years. Well, at that time, it was only 30 years, but you get the point. There's a lot of this going on, and I am not, how shall we put this, very tolerant of people doing their research by proclamation. Investigation, fine. But not proclamation.
I'd ask about the Roswell crash in terms of bodies. You know, this was a controversial thing, and I've watched a lot of the television programs, and I've even talked to some Roswell natives that knew people. In other words, we are fortunate enough that it's still close enough to us in a time frame where people remember. And people talk to other people, and it isn't just, you know, a colorful story that's been embellished on. I mean, this we're in too close, and the circumstances are far too unusual, you know, for it to be just total conjecture upon the part of people. But what does there exist in regards to documentation in regards to the bodies?
I don't know of any documentation, firsthand documentation. I was the first to hear Glenn Dennis's story, and it wasn't in public, private conversation. There were people around, a busy day in a small town in New Mexico on Billy the Kid Day. He was running the hotel, and so there's music in the background of the tape that I made of our conversation, but he got his information from a nurse at the base. We haven't been able to find the nurse. I did find somebody who remembers her, and he described her to me. I asked him, what did she look like? I didn't tell him what I was told they looked like. And he described her exactly the same way Glenn had. This guy was a high school principal, incidentally. He had taught science. There was no reason to expect that he was making it up. He wasn't getting publicity. He wasn't making money. It was a very interesting conversation. I don't know of any written material. I have also never seen an analysis of the materials of which the craft was made, whether the skin of the craft, whatever you want to call it, or some of the stuff that was inside that might have been high-tech, solid-state physics devices, if you will. I have never seen such an analysis. People ask me that question. I say, look, I don't have a need to know or a security clearance for that information. And that's one of the real problems here is many people think you can't keep secrets. We know everything. I mean, that was 62 years ago. Obviously, it's all been declassified because the government always declassifies stuff after X or Y years, you know, 25 years, 20, 30, people guess. That's malarkey. Go to the Eisenhower Library. They still have almost 300,000 pages of classified stuff there.
Yeah, but, you know, you're looking at something of extraterrestrial importance, you know. We can't right now today define the reasons and the how and the why of the assassination of President Kennedy. We are still a nation in the dark.
That's true, isn't it?
You know, I mean, and this has to do with something from our own planet, something that occurred in our backyard in Dallas, Texas, on television, okay? And we can't get straight answers about that. I believe there are straight answers. I believe there are perfectly logical explanations as to why all that took place. Probably not pretty explanations, but nonetheless, explanations. So, I mean,
but we don't have them.
No. And I guess the question is why would anyone in the general public be foolish enough, or why would any professional be foolish enough to think that you're going to get straight answers in regards to Roswell?
I don't know, because I suppose it makes them feel better. They don't need to worry about it. It couldn't have happened, because if it had, we know about it, and we don't, so it must not be, and that's the end of that.
Well, I remember seeing a television special, though, where they talked about somebody from a funeral home or something supplying coffins that were taken to the location, and bodies that were moved and transported. Now, I can't remember the particulars.
Glenn Dennis was his name.
Okay.
I was the first man he talked to.
Okay, but all this was told, and, you know, and there were other people that corroborated the story. I mean, that you said, yes, we remember this, yes, we remember that. I think you could get a jury conviction based on what I saw, if they were all...
I think you probably could, as long as your standards is the preponderance of the evidence. If you want proof, you know, prove to me that we have atomic bombs. Show me one. You say eclipses happen, that is when the moon comes between the earth and the sun. I'll have my camera tomorrow morning at 11:30. You show me one. Otherwise, I won't believe you. That's an ridiculous demand. It doesn't fit the situation. It is inappropriate. And so, yeah, the same thing here. And again, people, how many Americans are really well acquainted with the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office? They announced less than 5 years ago, that they had canceled a program at Boeing looking at improved architecture for space spy systems, and they had already spent $14 billion. Now, that's not six professors and 12 grad students, but were we told about it? No, we were not. The first spy satellite that was successful, the Corona spy satellite, operated in 1960. Got more data than all the U-2 flights that had happened prior to that. And yet there wasn't a word in public until 1995, 35 years later. Of course secrets can be kept. We live in a society that thrives on them, but not by spreading them all around, but by withholding them, by limiting them, by the need-to-know process. When I was working on radiation shielding for nuclear airplanes, I used to read classified nuclear abstracts, and there were papers about radiation shielding for nuclear submarines. And it was secret restricted data, and I was cleared for secret restricted data. I had a Q clearance. But I couldn't get those reports. Why not? Because I didn't have a need to know, and Admiral Wick over on the other end wouldn't give it for me. I knew it was there because I had a clearance and could see the classified abstracts. Could I gain access? No. And if I didn't have a clearance, I wouldn't even know the stuff existed. So it really aggravates me when people don't understand how the security system works. And, you know, also I get people thinking that only big shots would have security clearances. Well, the secretary's got to have them. They're typing the reports. You know, everybody who works in the building has to have some kind of a clearance because you might run across something that was highly classified. So it's not just the guys at the top. All kinds of people. And so, you know, there's a real situation, in other words, in which obviously national policy has been we don't admit that aliens are visiting, that alien vehicles have crashed, that we have recovered bodies, that we have lost airplanes to saucers, which apparently demolished them. If you look at Frank Ficino's book, Shoot Them Down, it's about events of 1952. And we were able to determine that the United States government ordered military pilots to shoot down saucers if they don't land when instructed to do so. Don't ask me how you instruct an alien to land his spacecraft when you're on his tail. But, I have heard myself seven different stories of our planes not coming back when they went up to chase UFOs. If I've heard seven, there's got to be a heck of a lot more. These were quietly told me, not people looking for attention, you know, or fame, fortune, et cetera, et cetera. So the government has decided not to tell us that. And but people don't seem to understand that policies like that exist in a lot of areas. It's not just flying saucers.
How many people have come to you confiding something, telling you, now, Stanton, whatever you do, please don't repeat this and don't do under no circumstances reveal the source. But let me tell you what I saw. How many times is that
happened? Many dozens of people. I'm negotiating with a couple on the internet right now, as a matter of fact. And they're scared. That's the problem. They've heard me on the radio, so they think they can trust me. But gee, you know, how much risk do they want to take? And so there are a lot of them out there who would like to speak out, but part of it is genuine patriotism. There are people, especially from the Second World War time frame, you know, loose lips sink ships and all that sort of stuff. What I'm looking for, as much as anything, is people who, like retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose, who was in General Roger Ramey's office at 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, when the Roswell wreckage came in. And in our last conversation, he said, you know, I like what you're doing, Stan, and if I remember anything more, I'll let you know. What can they do to me now? He was 87 when he said that. So, you know, I need some of those people who say, what have I got to lose? The world needs to know about this. My kids, my grandkids, my great-grandkids need to know. Anybody out there, I'm on the internet. My website is www.stantonfriedman.com. Tells you my email address, my phone number, how to get in touch with me. I don't hide from people because I want to hear from those who know something and who are willing to talk to me. And I don't use names without permission. It's counterproductive. Because if I do, then other people won't talk to me. And so, you know, anybody out there, we're waiting.
You told me you were the first one to hear the story of the bodies from the gentleman. Just, you know, I would like for you to just kind of capsulize that. What was it exactly that this man told you, or what he reported to you?
He was working at the Ballard Funeral Home. His job, they had the contract with the Air Force to handle funerals. There were plane crashes. There were babies that died in childbirth. And there was a big base, thousands of people out there. And there were automobile accidents when military guys got killed, etc. And he told me that he got a call from the guy that he dealt with at the base, asking him what size coffins they had, and is there a way to preserve bodies that are out in the desert, and so forth. He recommended dry ice, incidentally. It's pretty hot in Roswell in the summertime. But he also told me that the Ballard Funeral Home ran the ambulance service, too, and that wasn't unusual for towns to have their hearse do double duty. You know, you got a big vehicle, obviously big enough to hold the body. If you need an ambulance, that isn't going to get used very often. There weren't a lot of people in Roswell altogether, 25,000 in town, a few thousand at the base. He had dropped an airman off at the base, at the back, a guy with an injured leg, and he went in. There was a nurse that he kind of liked there, and he went in to see her, and while he was going in, he sees an Army ambulance that had pieces of strange stuff in it. And he noticed that. It was kind of weird. He goes inside, sees the nurse, and she tells him he better get out of there, which was a very unusual response. And then the military threatens him. You don't say anything. You don't know anything. And they're threatening him, and he says, I'm a civilian. You can't threaten me. And they say, we use guys like you for dog food. And, you know, not a very pleasant conversation. Okay, the next day, he meets with the nurse at the officers' club. He had privilege, and she was a nurse. She was an officer. And she tells him that she was asked by a couple of physicians to participate in, I'll call it a dissection or autopsy, whatever. And she remembers how bad things smelled. That was the thing that got to her. But here were these little creatures. And their lower arm was longer, or was shorter than their upper arm, which is the opposite of the way it is for us. They had four long, skinny fingers. They were little guys, maybe 4 feet tall or so. Big heads. She gave the descriptions. And he agreed not to talk about it. She obviously had to tell somebody. She was frightened. And when he next went to contact her, she was gone. She was sent to England, he was told, by other nurses. And then the word was that there was a plane crash and she'd gotten killed. And the trail ended there. And so, you know, that's an interesting story. But we also have a story of bodies out in the plains of San Augustine, which crashed. It's 100 miles west of the other site. And they were small guys, big heads, skinny, four long fingers, as one witness said, made a good violinist. Not much in the way of lips, ears, nose, little holes for the nose and for the ears. Big eyes. Consistent story. These are two entirely independent stories to me. And why me? Because I was out there looking, talking, trying to get more information. You know, I hate these guys who sit at home and sit in their office, but they don't go out looking for data. I mentioned Colonel or retired General Dubose when I found him. I had to go look for him. I didn't even know if he was alive or not, but I went to called West Point, found out he was still living, managed to locate him, et cetera, et cetera. These guys don't do things like that. They just sit back and do their research by proclamation. So we have at least two stories about bodies being found. Oh, there's another story. I found through somebody else, not through these guys, a photographer who was working in Washington, D.C., military. And he had a high clearance. He'd been involved in filming some of the nuclear test stuff. And he got a call, he and another associate. They were flown to Roswell. They were driven out there. And he's using one of these old speed graphics with the film packs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you take a picture, you pull it out, turn it around, take another picture, give the film pack to somebody else, and take a bunch more like that. And one of the things he was doing is they had a tent out there, and he was filming the bodies. Now, what am I supposed to say to all these people? Again, they weren't looking to be somebody. As a matter of fact, with Glenn Dennis, I was down there at the time because Unsolved Mysteries was going to be filming a bunch of people, including me, for their program about Roswell. I had instigated the program and had brought a whole bunch of us in. And I asked him if he wanted to be on the program. I bet I can get you on, I told him, because I had instigated that program. No, he didn't want to go on the program. Who needs it? You know, fuss and muss in the town kind of thing. And so... If there are other people out there, I've heard other stories, but second and third hand, it's kind of funny. I signed books in Dayton, Ohio, not far from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Seven different people came up to me telling me quietly that they worked out at the base and they had heard stories about beings being out there. What am I supposed to do? Oh, you're lying. You know, is that how we operate in this world we live in? So, a lot more than that, I don't have. Now, we have all the abduction reports, of course. There's plenty of people who observed aliens. I mentioned the physical trace cases, one-sixth of the 3,800 or so that Ted Phillips has collected involve reports of beings, and they fall in the same general description. It's funny, nobody talks about creatures with two heads or four arms or three legs or anything like that. They're humanoid. Does that mean they're all the aliens out there are humanoid? Of course it doesn't. The guys who breathe ammonia go to Jupiter for their vacation, you know. But we make do with the evidence we have. It's like I've talked to police officers here in Canada where I live, RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and I said, when there's a lot of publicity given to a particularly heinous crime, you know, a terrible murder or something, and you ask the public for help, do you get many responses? He says, oh, yeah, we get hundreds of calls. People really do want to help. But for one thing, they're scared. There's a bad guy around here someplace. I say, what percentage of those are useful? Oh, 2 or 3%, but that's how we solve most crimes. So nobody's saying that every story of every so-called witness is the truth. Who would dare to say that? But they don't have to be. You know, it's kind of like the same goes for documents. People say, you say the MJ-12 documents are genuine. I say, no. I say four of them are genuine. There's over 100 that I say are not genuine, and I've spelled out the reasons in my books. It's perfectly natural for garbage to be put out if good stuff gets out first, to take attention away from the good stuff. You know, hopefully the bad ones rub off, so to speak. So the question isn't, are all UFOs alien spacecraft? Or do all the witnesses who claim to know something about Roswell, are they all telling the truth? That isn't the question. The question is, are any? I mean, you know, I'm a nuclear guy. There are two generally available isotopes, really one, uranium-235, that is fissionable. You got to make plutonium, so you don't go out and find it in the fields. There are hundreds of isotopes that aren't fissionable. So what? You want to build a reactor? You want to build a bomb? Use the one that is. And so, yes. There's a lot of garbage out there, a lot of bad testimony, a lot of people making up stories, but it's true in every area. And the job of science and journalism is to sort and sift and come up with something reasonable when you get finished. Throw out the junk.
Wasn't there testimony that the autopsies were performed by some guys from pathologists, I guess you would say, from Walter Reed? Isn't that the ones that supposedly?
There's a lot of talk. There was the Air Force Institute of Pathology, some title like that, based in Washington. And, you know, they are concerned about autopsies, especially if there have been new weapons used, for example. You know, you got a bunch of dead soldiers, and they don't look like they were just shot by bullets or something. You got to have people who know human anatomy and know it very well and can be exposed to, you know, pretty bad stuff. I suppose it was poison gas, you know, stuff like that. So there are all kinds of stories, and some of them include the notion that it's Randolph Field, I guess, in San Antonio, where there are people who specialize in humanoid studies, if you will. Some have done work on apes, you know, other, but similar, simian pathology, if you will. We don't know. None of those doctors have really gone on record saying, I did it. I autopsied an alien. Those guys haven't really gone out there. There are stories, but none that I would hang my hat on and say I'm 98% certain this is the truth. I wish I could say there was. And if anybody's listening knows, please let me know. You can find me at www.stantonfriedman.com. It tells you how to reach me. It's easy.
Now let me ask you this question. Is whatever became of Dennis? Is he still alive, or is he...
He's still alive, but he's in his 80s. And with some of the mental degradation that moves in those age circles. I mean, I'm 75, and I'm getting close, and I understand that... So Glenn isn't doing public appearances anymore, not surprisingly. He is on record. I mean, one of the things on my website is a DVD, Recollections of Roswell, which has testimony from 27 firsthand witnesses. If anybody wants to know what the firsthand witnesses said, it's there. It's a DVD. It's, 105 minutes, I think. So, you know, we're not talking about 30-second clips. You can watch these guys now, even though most of those people are dead, incidentally, not surprisingly.
Well, you know, for someone to say, like, for example, you know, and I heard the statement made just recently that there was no crash. In other words, there was no crash there, that this was a cover-up for another type of governmental classified program. And then you mentioned to me, you were talking about the recovery or the wreckage coming in, and someone was telling you that they were present when the wreckage came in. How can they come up with something like this? I mean, it seems to me that really all we have is question marks. We don't really have a lot of concrete answers in regards to Roswell. Roswell has made more noise in history and has got more attention than basically anything so far. I mean, people anywhere are familiar with Roswell.
I've lectured in 16 other countries outside of Canada and the United States, and I always get asked about Roswell, whether it's Australia or Turkey or Israel or Finland. I've been there, and Roswell is an event that strikes people's fancy, and part of it is because of the caliber of the people who were involved. Remember, we're dealing with the 509th. This is the only atomic bombing group in the entire world at that time. Not only did they drop the two bombs on Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they also dropped two more during Operation Crossroads in the Pacific in 1946. They were the only military group in the world in 1947, high-level security, you know, hand-picked officers, that could say that they were ready to drop more atomic bombs. There weren't a lot of them around at that time, incidentally. But it's amazing how the noisy negativists always avoid telling you that. They'll talk about Colonel Blanchard, the base commander, Oh, he must have been sent to Siberia for putting out that stupid story. They don't tell you he got four more promotions and was a four-star general and vice chief of staff of the United States Air Force when he died of a massive heart attack in the mid-60s at his desk at the Pentagon in Washington. You don't get four more promotions. They all have to be approved by Congress at that level by being some kind of an idiot. You know, and I get a kick out of the head of the skeptics group, Joseph Nickel, 3 degrees in English, and has worked as a magician. Those are really good background characteristics for scientifically evaluating UFOs. But he said more than 10 years ago that, the PR guy just put out this story to get attention for himself. He didn't even know the guy's name. And 10 years later than that. That was at the time of the 50th anniversary. And I know he said that because I was on the other end of the phone. I was being interviewed in Roswell, and he was in Los Angeles. We could hear each other but couldn't see each other. 10 years later, he puts out an article saying, an inexperienced PR man put out an unauthorized press release. He still didn't know his name, apparently. Walter Hout is his name, and he's deceased. He's been on record for years. I was the first to locate him. Because I went looking, not because he called me. He didn't. I contacted him. I got lucky. Let's tell the truth. I called the Roswell paper. I looked up, oh, yeah, Roswell's got a newspaper. This is before I'd ever been there. And I said, I'd like to talk to the editor from 1947. Well, he's long gone. What can I do for you? Well, I got a story here. Bill Moore found a story about Roswell in a Minnesota newspaper front page story of July 8th, 1947. And I said, I've got this story about the base public information officer, a guy named Walter Hout, his name is spelled four different ways. And before I could finish the sentence, the gal on the other end says, oh, his wife works here. What? You know? So, yeah, I found him. I was a little lucky, but luck is what happens when you go looking to get information, you know. So what I'm getting at here, there's been more nonsense, like Joe Nichols' claim that it was an inexperienced. The guy, Walter, had flown more than 20 bombing missions over Japan. He was a navigator bombardier. He was chosen to drop the instrument package in one of those two nuclear weapons tests at Operation Crossroads because he was one of the best bombardiers around. Was he old? No. But guys aged pretty quickly during World War II and given appropriate responsibilities. And so he wasn't just a guy who walked in off the street, I'd like to offer you my PR services. No, not at all. And so when you get people like that, you know, and when you get the critics. Well, as a good example of the criticism, the Air Force has put out not one, but two huge reports about Roswell, both riddled with false claims. And one of them was, in the first one, the Roswell Report, Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. And the Air Force supplied the fiction, of course. They said that was their last word on the subject. Well, that was 1994. 1997, just in time for the 50th anniversary, they put out another report, not quite as big. This was only about 250 pages. The first one's about 1,000 pages. This one, case closed, Roswell report, case closed. This was the crash test dummies nonsense. Now, you know, I talked to the man who had headed that program. His picture is in the report, and I went out and found him. Colonel Madsen, he was. And he pointed out to me, he was a little irked at some of the things that were being said, that, look, the crash test dummies had to be the same height and weight as pilots, 175 pounds, 6 feet tall. There's a picture there. That's besides pointing out that they weren't dropped until 6 years after the event. So misinformation, false information, misleading information, clearly it was of concern. They even lied about me, and I don't like that, frankly. But,
what did they say about you?
Well, in one report, in the crash test dummy report, they said that Don Berliner and I, and he's my co-author on Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, still available through the website. They said we treated Dr. Moore and, what's his name, Guildenberg, Duke Guildenberg, very rudely. Well, we didn't. We had put a letter in the paper in Socorro, New Mexico, home of the New Mexico Institute of Technology that Dr. Moore was connected with. And they contacted us, and we met with them. And it was clear neither one of them knew much. But we were not rude, crude, or unattractive. And Don and I talked about that. What's the point of being that way? Neither one of them knew what was going on, but that's beside the point. We didn't say that to them. We pursued finding out what it is they knew and how they knew it. And so that was one thing. They had me, in the other report, they had me working separately from Bill Moore and Charles Berlitz, who did the first Roswell book, The Roswell Incident, 1980. I worked very closely with them. I got Bill involved. He got Berlitz involved because they'd worked on a book about the Bermuda Triangle. Or Berlitz had worked on a book about the Bermuda Triangle. They worked on the book together, The Philadelphia Experiment. I got a percentage of their royalties. It wasn't separate from them. And they had the date wrong, so it made it sound as if Major Marcel came running to the Air Force. He didn't. They mentioned the National Enquirer. Didn't point out I was the one who gave Bob Pratt, the National Enquirer reporter, his address, Jesse Marcel Sr.'s address, because I knew the book was coming out and because Bob Pratt was a darn fine reporter. I'd met him. I'd talked to him on several occasions. So the story was wrong about what the connection was between all of us. They made it sound like I got my leads from the National Enquirer. It was the reverse. I got theirs from me. There were other things, but it was enough to get me irked that, there's Colonel Weaver, the author of the first report. Turns out his specialty is disinformation. So it's no wonder, I guess, that he was given the big job. You got to get this story out of the way. And if you put out a big enough report, nobody will read it, but just tell them what the results are.
Well,
other things,
I guess the thing that I was going to ask about, and of course we've talked about a few things, and I don't want to hold you on the line too long, but the claim when someone says that Roswell never happened and this was all counterintelligence to cover up something else, of course the question comes to mind, what on earth, or is that the wrong statement, could be what could they be possibly trying to cover up by creating a story like Roswell? It just doesn't make much sense to me.
No, it doesn't to me either. I can't find any rational. I've heard several different explanations, and they just don't make any sense. People have said, that there have been programs that have been done with the impact of disinformation, trying to cover other things up. Well, New Mexico is a great place for that. The first nuclear weapons test at Trinity site, July 16th, 1945, it was a very successful test, and was seen from 100 miles away, even though it was done in a place where there ain't nobody. I've been out there at Trinity site. Anyway, the people were calling sheriff's departments. And so after a few days, an article appeared in the paper. An ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately, nobody was injured. It was a total lie. But it was a cover story, and it was covering up the fact that we had tested an incredible, new, horrible, wonderful, war-ending weapon, an atomic bomb. I don't blame them for lying. So, yes, there have been many occasions where cover stories were put in place. But why would you make up something as silly as a flying saucer crash? There had been sightings for 2 weeks before this, Kenneth Arnold's and about 1,000 others we now know, well, actually 2,000, all over the place. But how can you throw out the witness testimony? I mean, Major Jesse Marcel, the first person I talked to about this, is a base intelligence officer, for goodness sakes. He briefed pilots when they were sent on these long simulated missions. It had begun 23 hours, and he gave them their information, where they should go, what their targets were, what happened, all this kind of stuff. Dubose that I mentioned, retired general, he was the chief officer for the head of the 8th Air Force, which the 509th was part of. And he set up the Air Force's search and rescue teams. I did a lot of checking on him. We're supposed to throw out his testimony because we don't like it? Because it indicates that there was a crash saucer? I mean, that's nonsense. So, no, I didn't talk to Colonel Blanchard, who was later a four-star general, because he was dead when I started this stuff. And there were other people I couldn't talk to because they were dead. But people like Don Schmidt and Tom Carey have also interviewed loads of witnesses. Kevin Randall has interviewed a lot. These were people who had nothing to gain and everything to lose by telling the truth about what happened. And so you can't throw out that testimony and come off up to the top and say, oh, well, this was all a phony story meant to cover up what? What did it cover up, and how do you know it, and what's the connection between what you're saying and what the witnesses tell you about what went on out there? And people don't want to ask those questions, I guess.
Well, what in the way of, in your research, and I know we've been through this with the movies and the books and all that, but for the listeners that have just tuned in, folks that are curious, what was reported wreckage-wise? What did people physically see?
Okay, Jesse told me that, and I talked to this, incidentally, who also handled pieces of wreckage, and of course Jesse Marcel's son, Dr. Jesse Marcel, a colonel in the military, called back in at age 68 to serve in Iraq as a flight surgeon, a helicopter pilot, medical doctor. I mean, these are very legitimate people. The description that Jesse told me and that we get from what the rancher said to other people is that we're talking about a lot of very lightweight material, shiny, metallic, some bakelite kind of stuff. And the lightweight material was extraordinarily strong. It couldn't be cut. It couldn't be bent. It couldn't be burned. People tried with their cigarette lighters, you know, and stuff like that. And a lot of the lightweight material was this, call it memory metal, I don't know what else to call it. You'd fold it and fold it and fold it again, and it would unfold on its own. And Jesse, in our first conversation, this is way back in 1978, told me that there wasn't anything conventional out there. He'd seen airplane crashes. You expect wire. You expect vacuum tubes. You expect little signs saying made in Oshkosh and part numbers and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Airplanes are that conventional kind of stuff. There wasn't anything like that, and he figured it had to have exploded in midair because otherwise there's no way to, without a crater, and there was no crater, no way to spread this stuff over such a large area, perhaps 3/4 of a mile long, a few hundred yards wide, strewn with all this crazy stuff. There were some I-beams about 3/8 inch high, that had strange, I'll call it writing, symbols along the inside of the eye, and you couldn't break. And there were other pieces that a guy, one of Marcel's people, took a sledgehammer to. It seemed so strong. Put it, you know, one end on a rock, a small piece, less than a foot across. One end on a rock, one on the ground, slammed it. It couldn't put a dent in it. Now, we don't know anything like that. This is 1947.
But it was a weather balloon.
A weather balloon and radar reflector combination. Remember, the Air Force came up with four explanations. First, it was a flying saucer, loud and clear. Second, it was a radar reflector weather balloon combination. Third, oh, it was a mogul balloon combination. Super classified. So classified that they were left to rot in the desert. Only the mission was classified. There was no classified materials there. The mission, incidentally, was to build a constant altitude balloon. It would stay way up there for a long time, and it had sonobuoys on it, things that would listen for the sound of a Soviet nuclear explosion should one occur. One hadn't at that time, incidentally. And so the balloons were standard, the sonobuoys were standard, the radio systems were standard, and they were held, it was a chain of balloons at 20-foot intervals, about 20 to 24. They varied. So there was nothing like that found. And the ranchers all knew what balloons were like because there were weather balloons launched every single day at Roswell. You need high-altitude winds. How else are you going to get them? So these had weather balloons with radio transmitter or radio sound balloons and stuff like that. Jesse Marcel had a course on this kind of stuff, a radar and balloons and weather.
So he was well-versed. He was very well-versed in that area. He knew all about
that stuff. That's right. That's right.
Well, you're not going to hit a weather balloon with a sledgehammer, that's for sure.
Well, that's right. And you're certainly not going to find stuff that you can fold and fold and fold and then would unfold on its own. You know, not in 1947. And so the stuff was weird. And when he brought the stuff into the rancher brought the stuff into the sheriff's office. And he only did that because he had gone to the little town of Corona to do his shopping on Saturday, July 5th. It was a bar, pool hall, you know. They lived out in the boondocks. The ranch was 10 miles from the nearest road, for goodness sakes. And it was only there that he heard about flying saucers, and he was saying, well, I got all this crazy wreckage, and somebody's got to clean it up because the sheep won't cross the debris field. And pretty soon, sheep will eat almost anything, and no rancher wants that. He had found balloons. He knew what a balloon were like, and also standard weather balloons. They were neoprene back then. They were not polyethylene like these huge balloons that they often show on television. They weren't like that. None had flown at that time. It was months before they were flown. And so, as he said in the next day's newspaper, after he had been reprogrammed by the military, the one thing he was sure of is that it wasn't a weather balloon because they knew what they looked like. The ranchers used to store them. One ranch there had a lot of them in a water I call it a silo, you know, a tank. And they would stick them in there because they don't want the cattle and the sheep getting into these things, you know. So there's nothing there that's remarkable. Nothing at all.
Well, I guess I wonder what the motivation would be for someone to go on record at this point and say that the crash probably did not happen. And there were no bodies recovered, and this is all a cover-up of some other government operation. I don't know. I can't even think in my wildest imagination that even a government cover-up specialist would try to propagate something that ridiculous, and think that people were going to believe that and people were going to buy it. I mean, it just doesn't. You know, I mean, did you ever see the television series? I guess it was a TV series called Taken, the Steven Spielberg thing.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and I wondered a little bit after that if that wasn't Spielberg making some sort of a statement. You know, because I mean, it was a lot of fiction there. But I mean, the general public though has been conditioned. I mean, they have heard this story told over and over. They've seen the documentaries on television. Many folks have read books, you know. And so I guess, to me, it would be foolhardy to try to just say, no, none of this ever happened. Man, I mean, that is just weird. you know?
The only thought that comes to mind that might have a little sense behind it is that they were trying to get people who knew something to come forward and call them wrong. How's that for a reverse conspiracy?
Well, you know what? That might work. You know, nothing is worse than having lived through some sort of crisis and then someone come along and say, you know, it's just like trying to tell folks of Jewish descent that the Holocaust never took place. I mean, you say that, and boy, you're going to get some angry people because they know.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
and
you are. And it's that kind of a thing. And, you know, human motivation puzzles me. People are always asking me why people tell false stories and stuff. I say, look, I'm a physicist, not a psychiatrist, and I don't know why a lot of things happen. Why do parents abuse their children? You know, doctors refused to believe that until about 50 years ago. You know, the kid fell down the stairs. Why do priests, certain priests sometimes, attack 10-year-old choir boys? And again, for many years, it was the kids the finger pointed at. How could you dare to say that about that respectable priest? Well, now we know that it happened. Do I know why? No. The question is what happened, not whether we know why. I mean, motivation is nice, but you want is facts to decide about events. And, you know, somebody told me, and I've said it before in the year, that Ted Bundy was considered a nice guy by people who knew him, but he was a serial killer.
So was Jeffrey Dahmer, you know. I mean,
well, yeah, another nice guy.
Yeah.
But you see my point, that I don't know why people do things like this, and what their motivation is and what they think they're trying to accomplish. There are a lot of phony stories. I mean, one book by a PhD was saying that, you know, basically, Jesse was paid money by the National Enquirer to make up a story. Yeah, it's baloney. Because I was the one who put the National Enquirer in touch with him, not the other way around. I get people saying, how come all those people came running to you, Stan? I wish they'd pay my phone bill and Bill Moore's phone bill for the year during which we were doing our darnest to find people. We found 62 people in a little over a year. That was before the internet.
Wow.
And then we found roughly 30 more in the next 6 years. I was on the phone one heck of a lot. My wife will tell you she was paying the bills. And, you know, they didn't come running to us. We had to go look the hard way, you know.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you have on tap for this upcoming MUFON conference in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, coming up December the 5th? What?
Well, it's the title of the talk is Flying Saucers and Science, and I'm the last speaker, so maybe it's in the afternoon. I'll be finished. Everything's finished, I think, by 5, and it starts at 9 in the morning. The title of the talk is Flying Saucers and Science. It's the talk of my 2008 book. And the idea is to sort of take you by the hand and look at things in a scientific fashion. First step, what's the evidence? Let's look at the evidence first before expressing an opinion. So I'll go over quickly 5 large-scale scientific studies, and I'll guarantee you fewer than 3% of the people will have read any of them. I'll deal with the objections. You can't get here from there. So I'll show some pictures of nuclear rockets that most people have never seen, don't know exist. I'll talk to them about the enormous amount of energy available in the fusion process. You know, we're not stuck at the level of chemical rockets anymore. It's like saying the most up-to-date system for doing computations is a slide rule. Well, it isn't. The computer on my desk is worth much more in its capability than the 704 computers that we were using at GE in 1958. We were spending $100 million that year on nuclear airplane development. Never built one, but came close. We operated Jetsons on nuclear power. But so I'll go into the technology end. I will talk about the Betty and Barney Hill case because I need to, when we say, can you get here from there or not, you have to say, well, where's here? And I don't talk about other galaxies. Andromeda's 2 million light years away. Who cares? I talk about Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the Betty and Barney Hills, the star map and all that stuff. They're only 39 light years away, 39.3 light years. There's a big difference in the technology problem between going 39 light years and going 2 million light years. You know, I can walk down to the grocery store a mile away, but I can't go from here to Los Angeles and back in 2 hours. It's a different problem than the grocery store. So I'll cover that. I'll deal with Roswell. I'll show pictures. It'll be a fast-paced hour and a half or so. It's a PowerPoint presentation. Much as I like using slides, they don't make the projectors anymore. I'm going modern.
Well, you know, I guess I'm looking forward to it, and of course I've read the book, and I can tell you folks that Flying Saucers and Science is probably the best book I have read to date on the subject.
I appreciate that.
Once you pick it up, you're not going to put it down until you're finished. And you're going to be looking for excuses to sneak and continue reading. It's one of those kind of reads. And with all the talk that's been going on recently, I'm looking forward to it as well. And of course, this is the Tennessee State MUFON organization that is actually putting this on. Once again, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. All the details will be up on our website at radiodisclosure.com, along with links back to Stanton Friedman's site. And, of course, on his site, you can find out all you need to know about all the various books and things that that he's written. The book prior to Flying Saucers and Science was what, Stanton? It was the...
Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience by myself and Kathleen Martin, who's Betty's niece, has all the hypnosis tapes, all her correspondence, etc. And was around at the time the first part of the story was known. And then Betty called her sister, Kathleen's mother, and Kathleen was in the room. This is the day after the things happened. They didn't know about the abduction part at that time. But and there's one of the many myths. You talk about how can people say things. Oh, it was just a star-like object. It was Jupiter, says Joe Nickel. Well, they described it as it was seen less than 200 feet away with binoculars, and it had a double row of windows, and they could see beings inside. This is all before the hypnosis, and it's on record. How do these guys get away with making up such stories?
I only have one question, and it is, why is it the debunkers that I have met, who are, as you would say, professional debunkers, you know, why is it that as a layperson just walking into a conference or walking into a room and talking to them, why is it that all of them, bar none, come across so obnoxious? I don't understand it. In other words, I would think you would want to sell somebody on your idea. You can't do that by insulting people. And yet,
you know, that's a good question, and I don't have an answer for you. Maybe they know it's that they're not telling the truth.
I don't know. I mean, I was really quite taken back. I mean, I don't mind saying so. I met Joe Nickel at the Little Green Men Festival up in near Hopkinsville, Kentucky, in Kelly, the Kelly Green Men Festival, a little town there called Kelly. And, I mean, you know, he handed me his wooden nickel and basically insulted me in the first sentence that came out of his mouth. And I thought to myself, who is this guy, and why in the world do I want to talk to him, you know? And I just excused myself and walked away. Well, someone later on comes, well, that's Joe Nickel, you know? And I said, well, it may be Joe Nickel. I didn't know who he was at the time. But I wondered about that, because I thought, why is that? I mean, I guess maybe they've been beat up on too much. Maybe.
Well, maybe they know inside that they're not telling the truth, and so they've got to act consciously to cover it up. I mean, remember Joe's explanation for the West Virginia case, Flatwoods, was a 6-foot owl and a meteor. Now, there was no crater, there was no sonic, no noise, and nobody that I was right at the site asking people in the neighborhood about 6-foot owls, and they laughed. Ain't nothing, man. You know? So why does a guy put out that kind of garbage? I mean, he's being paid. He's got a full-time job as head of the CSI's Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. But now I know what you mean. And I've tangled with some of these guys, Michael Shermer. I've tangled with Seth Shostak. He's a gentleman most of the time. I'll give him credit. One of the SETI people, you know, silly effort to investigate. But maybe, I don't know. We need to find a psychiatrist about the will not to believe. How do we explain that? We get people defending a position that they achieved in a non-scientific, non-rational fashion, and they're stuck with it, I guess.
I don't know, but that's... And now, ladies and gentlemen, Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe on Radio Disclosure.
In early November 2009, at Ryan Wood's UFO crash conference in Las Vegas, a former police detective shared a tape-recorded interview he did on June 27, 1997, with a 72-year-old woman who had worked as a secretary for the War Department at Wright Field, Ohio, from 1942 until 1952. Wright Field became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Before marriages, her name then was June Crane, and during her work at Wright Field, she held a secret Q clearance under Atomic Energy Commission authority, heard about UFO crashes in New Mexico and retrievals of non-human bodies, and even held in her own hands a piece of what she called spaceship metal that she could not cut, and no matter how hard she twisted, the metal would always spring back to its original shape. The police detective who interviewed June Crane before her death is James E. Clarkson, 58 years old, who retired from the Aberdeen, Washington Police Department in 2000 because of a knee injury. Now Jim Clarkson investigates for a Washington state agency in the field of administrative law and is chief investigator for Washington State MUFON. Jim became interested in the UFO phenomena after reading John Fuller's book, Incident at Exeter, concerning 1965 UFO encounters in New Hampshire. Then, after he heard about the November 1986 Japanese airline pilot's report of large unidentified flying objects over Alaska and radar confirmation by Anchorage Air Traffic Control, Jim Clarkson began to read and study more about the mystery. That led to his preparing programs about the UFO phenomena for public libraries, including one in 1993 when he first met June Crane, then June Caba, after a second marriage.
I gave a program in the Ocean Shores Library in 1993, and there were probably 40-some-odd people there. And when I was all done, this very determined older woman approached me and just looked me right in the eye and said, "You're right. The government knows all about UFOs, and they're not telling the truth. They're keeping it all secret." And I said, "Well, how do you know this?" And she said, "I can't tell you." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" And she said, "Because I worked there." And I said, "Well, why can't you tell me?" And she said, "Because they'll come and arrest me." And at the time, I think part of her reservation in talking to me was that I was the detective sergeant for the Aberdeen Police Department at the time. That's a town about 25 miles away from Ocean Shores. And I think June was a little bit worried that maybe I would arrest her.
And how did you get past that psychological obstacle?
Well, I didn't for 4 years. I gave her a business card, and I thanked her, and I told her I would be really interested in talking to her in the future. And it wasn't until 1997 that I got a surprise phone call from her. And that occurred because of the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and at the same time that the public was becoming really interested in Roswell, and it was all over the news, that's when we got a heavy dose of, well, it was really all weather balloons and dummies. That was all over CNN. And one day out of the blue, my telephone rang, and I answered it, and there was June on the other end of the phone, and basically without even really saying hello, she said, "It's a damn lie." And she said, "Have you been watching CNN?" And I said that I had. And she said, "That's the same lie that they used before." She said they lied about balloons a long time ago, and they're still lying. Then she said something to me that I've never forgotten. She said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands, and I've survived cancer twice. What are they going to do? Shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one. And I'm not that slow." So I said, "Well, how soon can I be at your house?" So I ended up packing up a yellow pad and eventually a tape recorder, not right at first, but I started going to visit her at her home in Ocean Shores, and basically we sat up late at night and had coffee, and she told me her life story. And one time I asked her if I could tape record her, and that, of course, led to a very lengthy interview. The primary interview that I did with June Crane was at her home in Ocean Shores, Washington, and it was on June 27th, 1997, and it occurred at about 10:30 in the evening.
She would have been what age?
72.
And she lived until what year and age?
Well, she died in August of 1998, so she made it just past 73. I'm not sure how much June really knew about the state of her cancer, but she had a document drawn up where she said that she was giving me the rights to her life story. And she never told me that she was going to do that. She just dropped it on me.
Right.
And so I believe that she knew. And that, of course, adds credibility because it's considered universal in any court of law that if a person thinks that they're going to pass away, I mean, obviously, if they're going to die immediately, it's called a dying declaration. But just the idea that someone knows that they're wrapping up their life, that adds a lot of credibility.
And what would be the most important information directly related to Roswell, Wright-Patterson, bodies, UFOs, that you heard that night?
Well, she told me that by the time she left Wright-Patterson for the last time in 1952, she said that they were investigating at least three crashes of alien vehicles and that there was possibly a fourth. And she did not give me exact locations other than to say that Roswell was one of those. And then there was also an incident where she stated that she had coffee with a man who said that he had just flown from New Mexico and brought in bodies.
Now that is one of the audio excerpts that we have, and I'm going to play it right here.
This sergeant, his first name's Clarence, Master Sergeant. I still can't remember that man's last name.
Okay.
But he was in charge of that airplane, and when he came there...
What kind of an airplane?
Well, it was a river transport.
Transport, a military transport.
Yeah.
And what was it that he said?
Came in from New Mexico. He said, "What I brought in this morning," and he said that he brought two little men in. And he called them little green men. Then he described them as a greenish blue, and they were 4 foot tall, and they were dead.
We're talking about non-humans.
Non-humans, right? Right.
Did he say anything else about them?
No, not really.
Were there, like, maybe other ladies there, and he's sort of, like, showing off or telling... No, he wasn't showing off.
No. These guys don't show off.
This is a serious man.
When I'm saying engineers are sort of wacky, there's one thing they're not. It's not a wackiness like you'd think of just being acting like a fool. It's just... It's hard to explain. But they're very serious. They don't tell lies. They don't have jokes. They don't do anything like that. And so when they say something, you don't lie.
Was this Master Sergeant breaking security by talking about this?
No, because we were all secure. See, when you have security like that, you can't even take your husband to a party. If we had our Christmas party, we went and there was a guard at the door. And nobody but the people in the branch are the only ones. You can bring your husband and your wife. And you, when you're at home, you can't talk about your job because you got that in your head. You got security and you're cleared and you keep your damn mouth shut. That's all there is to it. And it's a big burden, because there's times that you'd like to talk about your job, but you can't.
Can you elaborate beyond what is on this audio excerpt?
Yes, because we also discussed this when we did not have the recording on. And she clarified that Master Sergeant Clarence, he started describing what happened, and initially everyone at the table was horrified, thinking that there had been a crash of a military aircraft, and everyone was sad and upset, thinking that perhaps somebody they knew had died in this crash. And then he clarified that no, the people who were killed were not human, and that this wasn't a crash of an airplane.
And that's where she heard him describe the little green men who were greenish blue?
Yes. There was something that happened later on that day that kind of adds weight to this entire conversation. That was the fact that June recalled that there was what she referred to as a too hot memo that came out later that day. And this meant that there was a courier from the commanding officer who went to every single person who worked there, and you were required to stop what you were doing, read the memorandum, and sign off on it stating that you understood it and that you would comply. And it was telling everyone that some irresponsible person has been discussing little green men and crash saucers, and that you will cease and desist immediately upon penalty of being discharged and possibly being prosecuted. And the two things that bothered June about this, one was, if there was no truth to what this master sergeant had told everyone, then why would they even bother with this elaborate procedure? And secondly, she wanted to know how the commanding officer knew about this so quickly, because she said it wasn't that long after she had the conversation with this master sergeant.
It suggests that the coffee room where they were talking was probably bugged, and it also implies that even within Wright Field and people with Q clearances, they would threaten anybody, since they all had clearances together, they would threaten anybody who even talked to each other about non-humans.
Exactly. So in other words, they did not view this as simple office gossip.
And the very fact that they would try to strong-arm their own insiders who had similar Q clearances, including the Master Sergeant and June and the others, and do it in such a way that they were saying there was no truth to this when they all knew that it was, shows that there was kind of this 1984 newspeak going on within Wright Field among the very people who had to have access to this information to do their work.
Absolutely. It reflects a consistent policy of denial, of suppressing discussion or inquiry, and that is also furthered by the other major revelation. She talked about the scientists and engineers who came back from New Mexico, where they had experimented with the V-2 rocket and later with the Aerobee rocket. They saw UFOs routinely while they were doing their work.
This was a cover-up. When this report in newspapers said, how could such a conspiracy exist, that's how it existed. Because it was right at the very start of it. Project Blue Book was not formed to investigate those things. It was formed to stop the people from thinking that's what it was.
And somebody else was actually investigating.
Right. They were being investigated by the Project Blue Book officers, yes. That's what Project Blue Book was all about. It was to try to squelch all talk of UFOs.
If I remember right, you mentioned that people in this group went to White Sands to do testing and then came back?
Yes.
And did they say that anything unusual had happened to them?
Well, they said they were just as thick as fleas up there. They'd sit at night, they'd sit on the outside of their motels where they would stand or the buildings, and they would just watch them go over all types and shapes. There'd be motherships, big ones with little ones coming out of it, and then they'd see them return, and they had different colored lights. Some had orange, sometimes red, yellow, different lights that they would see. And then what they would do, if the people, the engineers and scientists would report it that they saw them, They locked him up in a motel for 24 hours with no access to no radios, no people, no nothing. And they'd bring the meals into him, but have no contact with anybody. And they had him to write up what they saw. And then when they come out the following day, 24 hours later, they'd have him write it up again. And like the engineer said, to hell with it. I'm not going to report anymore. I'm not going to be locked up for 24 hours.
This accomplished two purposes. One of them was, obviously, they got at least two different accountings of whatever it was that was observed, and then they basically discouraged these scientists and engineers from discussing it further or reporting anything else in the future.
She talked with you about a subject that many of us have heard bits and fragments about, and that is metal that was found in the Roswell debris field.
Well, this is perhaps the most fascinating story, because here we're going from being an indirect witness to being a direct witness, because she said that she actually got to handle the metal.
Someone actually showed you a piece of something.
Yeah.
Was this during the same period of time?
Yes, 51, 52.
Okay, now, who showed it to you?
Okay, it was Lieutenant Rose is the one that showed it to me. Or Captain Wheeler. Now, it could have been one or the other of those guys, because they were both in personnel. He walked in, and he threw it on my desk. It was a piece, about this big, and it was...
About the size of a business card?
Yeah, about that size, and it was bent like this. And he says, June, you're a good wrecker. Tear that thing apart. Break that up. And I took it, and I bent it, and I twisted it, laid it back down, and it went... Got right back the same shape. I got my desk. He says, cut it, try cutting it. I got on my desk, I got my scissors out, and I snipped at it, and you know, there was no way I could cut that piece of metal. And it was as light as a feather. I had it in my hand. I would say that it didn't weigh as much as these two cards. It wasn't that heavy. It was so light, but strong, and it was about... the thickness would be about that thick, and so strong it was sort of a grayish gunmetal type of color, and you could see that on the inside there was a different, that there was a coating on the outside, both sides of it was the same, and the inside seemed to have a sort of a light lead colored center.
What were the edges of this like? Were they even, or was it like part of something else?
It was even. And I said, what is it? He said, piece of a spaceship. I says, well, what is it? And he says, piece of a spaceship. I said, I just come back from New Mexico and I brought it with me. See, he had no business having it in the first place. But he
was breaking security.
Yes, he was. Definitely.
Obviously, in 40 years, and even in my lifetime, being 45, I've seen improvements and changes in materials and plastic and metal and... Is it like anything you've seen since?
I always look at things, metal things, and I still have that curiosity because it still bothers me. And I have yet to see anything that would have those properties and look like that. And so light.
And in context, the situation was, I believe, that she was a young woman working in an office, and as has happened before in the history of the world, I think that a male was trying to impress a female, and he said too much and did too much, which is that he walked up to June kind of flirting and flippant and pulled a piece of this metal out of his pocket and then asked her to tear it up, asked her to try and destroy it or have some effect on it. And no matter what she did, she couldn't dent it, she couldn't tear it, she couldn't cut it or anything else. And yet, as she described very well, that when you folded it up, it would return to its original shape and it didn't look like anything had happened to it. And when she asked the officer, what is it? His response was, it's a piece of a spaceship. Now, she told me later on, this was not on the recording, that what happened was that somebody else walked in the room, and as soon as somebody else walked in the room, he jammed the metal into his pocket, and that was the last time she ever saw it.
This metal I understood that it was about the size of a standard business card, but I did not understand how thick it was.
It's not very thick. I think like maybe a couple, three, four business cards stuck together. I remember her holding her fingers like that. But every time she would say anything like that, she emphasized, but it was as light as a feather. It weighed nothing.
Right. And so maybe the size of a business card and an eighth of an inch thick.
That might be right.
Nothing about analysis?
No, because she didn't ever see that. She probably wasn't supposed to see this at all, and he probably wasn't supposed to have it. And if he was supposed to have it, he wasn't supposed to be using it to impress the office staff. Her paperwork, her documents showed that she was steadily promoted. And I believe that she was used as kind of a general purpose office manager slash tech secretary clerk. She told me about logging top secret material in and out of safes. That was part of her duties routinely. She also told me along the way she was required to type up standard response letters to people who reported UFOs. Now, she didn't say directly that she worked for Project Blue Book. My understanding was that she was tasked to write some of these letters and that the context was that these were just dismissive letters, you know, that the particular type of air vehicle that you have described is not possible given standard aerodynamic principles, etc. It was sort of just to get rid of the person type letter, and that she had helped write those letters.
And that reinforced her perspective of Project Blue Book as being really a misinformation project as far as the public was concerned, while behind the scenes, real scientists, real engineers, and real military people were doing serious investigations that never reached the public.
Exactly. That's the number one bottom line for what I learned from June Crane, that what the public is told and what these scientists and engineers discuss behind closed and very secure doors were two entirely different things.
And that she even had to take the typewriter ribbon out of her typewriter and put it in a safe every night?
Absolutely. In fact, she told me one time she got in trouble because she left one piece of paper in a drawer in her desk. She told me that they took security. They were extremely serious about it. And in fact, she described on one occasion that there was another person she worked with that she was suspicious of, and she described in detail how that person eventually got picked up by the FBI, and she never saw that woman again, and they actually took her desk away.
What is your perspective on why the overwhelming policy of denial in the interest of national security in its requirement for everyone involved to lie?
I think it starts back with one word, fear. And I think they were afraid of what they had found and what the implications might be, because bearing in mind that their fundamental job is to maintain the security of the skies over the United States and the interests of the United States anywhere in the world, and suddenly now we are confronted with something that is completely out of our control, and presumably if they have the kind of technology to come here wherever they come from, any sort of weaponry that they might possess would almost certainly be overwhelming. So they're afraid of what they found. They're also afraid of how the public might react, given our religious, social, and political institutions that are dependent upon everybody thinking that everything is predictable and okay. There's fear throughout this whole subject, and I believe that that's what dictated their response. They keep dealing with it from a mentality of fear. I can't imagine that they're hostile. I mean, if they were going to be hostile, I don't know why we wouldn't already know it. The only thing I could presume is that someone knows something that's so terrible that they are just scared to death that it will ever get out.
Something new at Radio Disclosure. We have been collecting items of interest, something that you might want. And once a month, we are going to have a drawing and give away some of these items of interest. Now, if you'd like to get your name in the hat, write us an email. Go to radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Shoot us an email and tell us a little bit about yourself, and tell us that you're interested in the items of interest. We're going to do a drawing once a month, and several people that listen to Radio Disclosure are going to get something really cool. We look forward to hearing from you. Go to our website, radiodisclosure.com, and send us an email. And keep listening and tell your friends about Radio Disclosure. That's all the time we have for Radio Disclosure today. We want to say thank you for listening, and join us again next week for Radio Disclosure, same time, same station. And we're looking forward to seeing you at the MUFON Conference, Saturday, December the 5th in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, with Stanton Friedman.